From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's what we know about Utah's bad air. It's bad for your health. But the experts say there's a lot we don't know. We've just scratched the surface in our understanding of the way our bodies respond to bad air. We don't know why some people are affected by it and others aren't. We don't know if there's a direct connection between bad air and certain conditions. We're not entirely sure what it is about these particulates that are particularly bad. Today in the program, we're wrapping up our series on Utah's bad air, and we're talking about what we know and what we don't know about the health effects of pollution. We're also asking what we've learned over the last few weeks. This is where you come in. What do we know about the role of industry or government or the rank-and-file Utah citizen? And now that the air seems to be clearing, how do you keep up the momentum of concern? Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For the last several weeks, we've been talking about Utah's bad air. In a series of programs, we've explored the role of industry on the problem, the part of transportation, of government, of citizens themselves. When we began the series, we were in the thick of the gunky air. It was cold out, so the brown haze was trapped in some of the state's valleys. And that's the other part of the problem, of course, geography. But today, as we wrap up the series, you can actually see out over the Salt Lake Valley to the mountains west of us, which raises the question of how you keep up the momentum of this conversation when we can all breathe again. First today, though, we're talking about what we know and what we don't know about the health effects of pollution. And then we're asking what we've learned over the last few weeks. So we're hoping to hear from you at that part of the program. What do you figure is the takeaway in this conversation about air quality? You can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Dr. Robert Payne is joining us today. He's the chief of the Pulmonary and Critical Care Division at the University of Utah School of Medicine. He's also the director of the newly formed Program for Air Quality, Health, and Society here at the University of Utah. And Dr. Payne, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
We also have with us Andrea Smarden, of course, reporter here at KUER. Her story about the health consequences about Utah's air pollution problem aired this morning. You can listen to that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. And Andrea, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
So, Andrea, I want to start with you. So in your story, you set out to understand the health effects of air quality, of pollution. And I wonder, were you surprised at how much we actually don't know?
Yeah, I was surprised. You know, I set out to do this and I said, how am I going to get this information? You can ask doctors and health emergency departments if they're seeing more asthma attacks and heart attacks and strokes and infant mortality during the winter inversion season. And a lot of them will tell you that they are, but that's not scientific evidence. That's not a scientific study. We're not isolating other factors at play. We can't say anything about what's causing these attacks for sure. So, that's not a reliable source of information. We have national and international studies that link, respiratory and cardiovascular problems with air pollution. But there's actually not a lot of specific Utah data on the public health consequences of air pollution. I asked around. There's some isolated studies at universities. The Utah Department of Health did a study of asthma-related visits to the emergency room in Salt Lake County and relating that to winter inversions. And they actually did determine that there's a correlation. There's a relationship there. There's more visits to the emergency department during winter inversions. But they still are not confident that they can make a statement about causality there. We just had a study of winter ozone air pollution in the Uinta Basin from the Utah State University, and they were looking at inversion and what causes the inversion, but they didn't connect the dots. We're seeing hospitals in the Uinta Basin have been admitting more and more asthma cases in recent years.
Yeah.
But this study that just came out, they weren't looking at the public health consequences. They were just looking at what causes that air pollution.
Okay, so
we're still not able to connect those dots. So we have this vague sense about health consequences of Utah's air pollution, but the public health costs have really never been quantified in a systematic way.
So, Dr. Payne, why? Is it because we're not looking, or we've been looking and we haven't figured it out?
We've been looking, But it is very complicated, and we're looking with better tools and looking more carefully all the time. We all live in this air, so we are all exposed, but we also have many other factors that come into play. And until we can start to, I like Andrea's term, connect the dots, until we can start to see the specific causal relationships, we can't really define the impact of air quality at the level of the individual. The other huge problem is every individual seems to respond differently. So we don't know why, if you take a group of people and expose them to the same pollutants, some of them may get heart disease, some get respiratory disease, some get no problems, lots of different changes. And we really have only begun to scratch the surface here to dig into this and understand how my health is changed by the particular pollutants I encounter.
Let's talk about – I want to get to what we don't know, because I think that's important. I guess what we know is pretty basic, that we do know it's bad for our health, right? I mean, that's a fairly basic statement, but we can say that.
That's a terribly important statement. We know that air pollution's bad.
Yeah.
We have levels that people talk about, how much particulates, how much ozone. But really, it's very clear that air pollution's bad and that there's a relationship, how much pollution – is clearly tied to the amount of health effects you have. And higher levels are bad, but even low levels still cause problems, so that we need to drill down deeper to understand why a small change can have a big effect on health. We know it's bad across the board.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You talked about the particular problem, one of them anyway, of Utah's bad air. That's this PM 2.5 particulates. I saw where you had talked about – you said that if you were going to design something to get into the lung and then out into the part of the lung where air and blood come into really close contact, you would make it 2.5 microns. You would design that particulate like that.
When I was in my training learning about aerosols getting into the lung and how we put medications into the lung, one of the first things you learn is the right size particle – to get deep into the lungs. Yeah. It's what we use when we administer drugs for asthma and things like that. That particle happens to be about 2.5 microns, just exactly the size we're measuring. There's a reason we're paying attention to that size, but it means that we have a huge burden of particles that are ideally designed to get out to this place in the lungs where, as you said, this is where air and blood come really close together. One of the striking things is that many of the health effects aren't just on the lungs. They are effects that presumably are transmitted by the blood. We don't really know the details, but they somehow involve transmission from the air to the heart, to the brain, to the uterus, you know, all over the place here. And so 2.5 is a very special size.
Yeah. Is there anything particularly unique? I know we have unique geography. We have – but isn't there anything particularly unique about – Andrea was just mentioning, you know, we know some general things about air pollution and its relationship to humans. But is there something particular that we need to understand about this place in that way?
Very much so. So I was looking recently. If you look across the United States, there are these particulates in many cities. And levels go up and levels go down. But when we collect those particulates and look at the chemical composition, the chemical composition in Utah is unique. We have a higher fraction of nitrates.
Yeah.
That is probably a relationship, some of our atmospheric chemistry, some of the geography and what blows in.
So it's the way things are interacting. It makes Utah particularly – I guess everything is unique.
Makes it distinctive.
Distinctive, yes.
And when you say what do we know, what do we not know, we know that these particulates are important for health, but how the composition of our particles impacts things compared to the composition of particles in Los Angeles, in Atlanta, in New York, again, we're just getting started there.
Mm. Andrea, one of the things that you explore in your story that ran this morning is this question of causality and the relationship. You spoke with a woman named Bridget James. Is she pregnant now?
Yes, she's pregnant.
Mm-hmm. She also believes that her oldest son has these developmental problems because of the bad air. And she's sort of convinced that he got a kind of overdose of these heavy metals that may be in the air. What does science tell us about that? You know, here's a mom expressing a theory.
Right.
Is there a direct correlation? What does science tell us about her theory?
Right.
Her idea?
Well, no. At this point, no doctor can say that we know enough to say, yes, your child's developmental problems were caused by air pollution or some that can't be isolated at this point.
Right.
There have been studies linking seeing a correlation between autism rates and exposure to air pollution. But once again, yeah, we can't say for sure that that's a cause. We can't isolate that as the determining factor.
There's the other thing you write about, which, of course, you mentioned in the story that Utah has the highest rates of autism in the country. Utah also has some of the worst air in the country. So what can we say about that? We're at the same point. We can't make the direct causal relationship.
Exactly. Yeah.
Does it matter, Dr. Payne, if we can't correlate the two? I mean, Bridget James has a hunch. She's a mom. She says there's got to be some difference. There's got to be something. I guess it's important to know it, but does it matter to in the scheme of things?
That's a great question, and I think it does. It matters in a couple of ways. We can think about air pollution as one single thing and say, well, I need to be away from all air pollution. And that would be good if you could be free of it. If it turns out that air pollution is involved in some way with developmental changes in children, with autism, with any of these things, it's still going to be an open question. What aspect of air pollution? Is this any old particulates? Is it related to particular small amounts of hazardous chemicals that are carried with the particulates? And the particulates are just the vehicle to get them there. I think until we have more information, it's not going to be practical for people to basically turn their lives upside down to try to get away from something when they don't know exactly what thing they're trying to get away from.
I wanted to – which this kind of raises something that Andrea, the governor, has said not so long ago. He talks about the important – I want to actually play a clip from the governor. Maybe you can set this up for us. But he's talking about that is what we lack is basic information that everyone seems to agree on.
Right. And, you know, what he's reacting to is, you know, physicians coming to the Capitol and trying to declare a public health emergency. And he's saying, you know, we don't know that it's a public health emergency. I mean, he's basically saying some people are exaggerating the problem in order to mobilize people to act. He suspects that maybe the problem is exaggerated or perhaps in some cases it could be minimized, but that what he's asking for is, he says, you know, I want the truth, or how do we find out more information about what the consequences actually are?
We need to find out what are the realistic solutions to our unique topography, geography, meteorology. What can we do with our industry folks? What can we do with our business, our apartments, our buildings, we ourselves, our travel, which is a big part of the problem during inversions, and see if we can't map a pathway to solution of the problem. And we need to have facts and truth and science that will help us.
So, Dr. Payne, in some ways you could interpret that as kind of a skepticism to act, resistance, because, you know, it may have an impact on industry, whatever it might be. But on the other hand, he's kind of right. There is information that we don't have and we should maybe get so we can all agree. Is that right?
Yes. We do know air pollution's bad.
Yeah.
We know with studies from along the Wasatch Front that during periods of intense air pollution, we have increased numbers of heart attacks. We have all sorts of increased numbers of deaths from heart attacks. We have increased respiratory disease. Those are facts that we understand. What we don't understand –
and that's directly related to bad air. We can say that.
That's directly related to our Utah periods of inversion.
Okay.
I mean, and these are studies that have been done in Utah, particularly by Arden Pope, who was one of Andrea's guests this morning.
Right.
But what we don't understand is those mechanistic details, and it's by understanding those that we can know who we need to be trying to protect, know ways to change this whole calculus as to how the valley impacts me. So we're still waiting for that.
So it seems like – I wonder if – Andrea, so is the it seems like the governor's waiting for these answers. Maybe this isn't fair. So I guess I'll ask it as a question. Is the governor, is the Herbert administration, are they waiting for more definitive causal links, more definitive information before they do something, before they act?
This is a really good question, and I'm not sure I have the answer. I mean, as I worked on this story, I'm still sort of left with the question is, do we need more information to do what we need to do to clean up our air? Is it a matter of information?
Right.
Do we need to know more about exactly what's happening in order to find out what is the best solution? Or is it a matter of political will and resources? Or maybe it's somewhere in between there. But, you know, the Division of Air Quality seems like it's doing its darndest to come up with, to meet EPA standards, which it hasn't done yet, on air quality. And they're supposed to have a plan by this summer that's going to bring us into compliance. And, you know, when you talk to those folks, they're trying really hard to come up with solutions. Whether they need more information to come up with better solutions, or whether they need more resources, to be empowered to regulate industry or put a tax on people who are releasing, you know, fossil fuels, whether that's us in our cars or industry. It's hard to know whether it just is that people need to be empowered to act, or whether we need more information to know exactly how to act.
What do you think about that, Dr. Payne? I mean, it's important to know, and this is something you've said we don't know. For example, we don't know what is the bad thing about PM2.5. We don't know if it's the size of the particulate or if it's chemistry. Like, that's one basic thing we don't know. But why does that matter? Why would that keep government from enacting policy that deals with the problem generally?
I think there's good evidence that we need to be dealing with policy generally. And as Andrea says, DAQ is working hard on this, and we are implementing these things. But to have the most effective policies, we need to understand the causal relationships.
Sure.
And I think
but you don't want them to be treated like a stalling technique. Do you see what I'm saying?
No, we need to be moving now. And DAQ has brought forth a whole number of steps as part of their state implementation plan. And we need to move that. We need to be actually more energetic about it, while at the same time trying to get more information. So we've got to have them both moving together.
Yeah. I wonder if this is a problem in the kind of well-intentioned effort to get the word out about the problem. Has there been some bad information that has slipped out? And are there myths that have sort of come up over the last few years in terms of the concerns about bad air?
I think that there is some bad information in terms of what our risk is and how much we have. We have risk, but we have episodic bad air, and we need to recognize that it is episodic and that it's different from a continuous circumstance. So that would be the first thing.
You often hear this. I'll be really specific. You sometimes have heard in the rhetoric of it all people making a relationship, and I'm not sure if they're just using kind of hyperbole, if they're actually saying that the air is as bad as smoking a cigarette or a pack of cigarettes. I mean, that is something you hear. I'm wondering if you think that's helpful.
I think it is helpful to give a comparison that, you know, cigarettes are something we all recognize as bad, and you are breathing in something that is bad for you, and that we need to change that composition. The ability to tie a certain number of cigarettes to a certain level of PM2.5 just isn't there yet. We know in terms of risk of early death that we can talk about the risk that smoking cigarettes for 25 years has, and we can talk about the risk that being exposed to higher levels of particulate air pollution has. And the particulate air pollution is smaller. It's a smaller risk, but it's a very clear one.
Yeah.
And it's the same kinds of diseases.
So what do you see, Dr. Payne, as kind of the way forward in terms of, you're fairly new to this program at the university. So have you put together, you know what you don't know, I guess. What's your strategy for the way forward? Do you have one yet?
So the way forward in terms of our program, we've said we've got a lot of people at the university who are very talented investigators who are either already doing things around air quality but perhaps not looking broadly enough. and we've got health researchers who are doing important work but aren't even taking air quality into account. And we need to bring all these groups together and start to build collaborations so we can tie how these particles develop, what the particles are, what the how the ozone comes about, and then tie that to the specific health effects so we can see where we can interrupt this whole unpleasant chain that leads to the illnesses we get.
You know, you often hear that in Chile, for example, the country, because they have so many seismic events, they have some of the best seismic researchers and technology. Could you apply that to Utah?
Totally.
Or should you apply that to Utah?
So when we were getting our program together recently, I gave a talk at the start, and I made an argument that we learn about the health effects of air quality in many ways, looking at different populations in different cities, looking at human exposure in specific experiments. What we have is the best naturally occurring laboratory around, and it is unfortunate that we're all exposed to air pollution, but from an investigative standpoint, it's a great opportunity to better understand the consequences and hopefully make a change, make an improvement.
Andrew, when you speak with people, whether or not they have the particular dots connected, can you give me a general sense of what you're hearing? I guess a lot of concern and a lot of anxiety.
You mean from the general populace or from scientists and
general
doctors?
Populace, that's what I'm talking about.
Yes, yeah. Certainly this season there's been a lot of concern, anxiety, people talking about, I can't take this anymore, I think I might need to leave.
Yeah.
Maybe that's dissipated a bit now that we're seeing some clear skies and different weather, but certainly a lot of concern. And there really was a sense of urgency this winter, and I'm curious to see how that will pan out now that we're moving into springtime and out of inversion.
I'll key on Andre's word urgency there, because Dr. Payne, that's a word you've used. That you sense that this is a unique opportunity because there's that palpable sense of urgency is the term you used.
It really is impressive. We've got people who haven't thought about air quality at all, who are now getting very interested in studying it and knowing what's going on. We have tremendous enthusiasm from the population, from the business community. They recognize the problems with air quality are impacting their business. They're impacting their health care insurance costs. They're impacting recruitment. And the state government now seems to be really mobilized on this. So I think this is an important time. And as Andrea said, and as you've said, we've got clear skies now. We need to keep the momentum going so that we can really move ahead with a better plan, both for ozone during the summer and then for the inversions next winter.
Dr. Robert Payne, Chief of the Pulmonary Division at the University of Utah School of Medicine, Director of the Program, Air Quality, Health, and Society here at the University of Utah. Dr. Payne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For being with us. And Andrea Smarden, reporter for KUER. Her story about the health consequences of Utah's air pollution problem aired this morning, and you can listen to it on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Andrea, thanks to you.
Thank you.
801-585-WEST, the number to join us, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are wrapping up our series on Utah's bad air. And as I've mentioned, we're doing this show at one of those times that clean air activists worry about when it doesn't seem so bad and when you can see across the valley. There's been a lot of talk, if not actual action, about air quality this winter, but how do you sustain that momentum in the good times? We invite you to join the conversation. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us now on the program, Terry Gilday. He's, of course, KUER's news director. Terry, welcome back.
Thanks, Doug.
Judy Faze is back with us. She covers pollution, climate change, nuclear waste for the Salt Lake Tribune. Judy, welcome back to you.
Hi, Doug. Thanks.
And Matt Pacenza is with us, policy director of the advocacy group Heal Utah. And Matt, welcome back to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
So let me ask you this sort of generally, all of you. And I'll start with you, Judy. it was a particularly – there's been a lot of particularly crappy air this past winter because we had a unique – reasonably unique, I guess, at least lately, winter. Is it unique? I mean, do you get a sense that you know, are you sensing a kind of groundswell of concern, or is it just because people were reacting to how bad it was?
Do I understand your question correctly, that you're asking how bad was it really according to the numbers, and then how bad was it really according to the public perception?
Yes.
Okay.
You phrased that better than I could have.
Well, in terms of how bad it is in comparison to the past, there have been times in the past when pollution was less regulated and there was less there was more pollution. But the levels did get pretty high this year. Cache Valley, I think, is still in some level of warning because of the inversion up there is still holding well into March, which is kind of unusual.
Yeah.
And then in Provo, in Utah Valley, they hit some pretty high levels this year, comparable to the ones they had back in, I want to say 2004, 2005, up in the Cache Valley.
Right.
So, yes, the levels were a little higher than they have been in the last few years, which were kind of mild winters. But in terms of the public perception, yeah, I think that there was a lot bigger awareness of air pollution and the impacts. It's been interesting over the years. I've been covering this issue for over a decade, and I've noticed that there's much more interest in it. The fact that there was a legislative hearing in October on a bill having to do with air quality was interesting. There was a lot of economic focus, which I think is valuable and important and a really potent driver for future discussion. And then there are the groups which have proliferated in the last few years around air pollution. And while every fact or perception may not be on the spot accurate or demonstrable with evidence, I think that those people are giving voice to a concern that a lot of people have.
Matt, how do you describe it? Dr. Payne said it was a palpable sense of urgency. Are you feeling that? Do you think people are feeling that as well?
I think it was absolutely true during January. And, you know, we found that there were these various phenomena, an internet petition, a Facebook group, rallies that folks showed up to where, you know, frankly, attendance was beyond our wildest hopes. So we really just saw flocks of people turning out, you know, getting online, signing things, wanting to be involved. There is an inevitable and natural phenomenon that as the valley gets cleaner, that urgency does pass. But it's up to us, and it's, you know, the activist community and the business leaders who have raised this issue to sort of make sure that folks know that, you know, it's not as if we've addressed the problem. We've simply sort of, you know, passed the moment in which the climatology works against us. So we need to keep it up for sure.
Terry, I'll go to you on that question. Are you sensing a kind of a groundswell of concern, in some way?
Well, it's interesting, Doug, because today is the last day of the 2013 general legislative session, and Matt's right. I mean, the atmosphere, especially at the Capitol, was an enormous sense of urgency, a lot of anxiety, a lot of anger, but not really finding a place to sort of pinpoint where that should go. But I think that the legislature has been the epicenter for a lot of at least the protests, and there are a couple of air quality bills, air quality related bills that are going to pass. There are quite a few that are going to fail.
Yeah, we'll talk about the particulars as we go, by the way, on that. But generally, yeah, that's where it's that people you're seeing people, and we should note there wasn't a lot of attention being paid to air quality legislation when the session began.
Hardly any, if any. And as Judy has pointed out before, when the session opened, there wasn't one bill filed dealing with air quality issues. And then Democrats sort of turned up the heat and Republicans have come out with some of their sort of conservative-minded solutions of their own.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's take some calls. Miriam is with us in Salt Lake. Miriam, welcome.
I literally just left the Capitol after – I'm just an individual – that I was able to successfully get the bill changed and workable concerning the Medicaid expansion. So I feel really good about that. But But as far as any of these bills, any of the bills that are good for the people, it takes so much work on the part of the professionals and businesses and the public. You know, we have to show the legislators how this will benefit and how they can afford it. I know from speaking with the legislators that they've always said, you know, we just don't always hear enough from the public. And I think until the public outcry gets much louder and joins with people like your guests and businesses, I don't know how much is going to get done. It's something I worked on as well. I have asthma. You know, couldn't go outside, or I just suffered.
Your question, Miriam, is related to whether or not there's a kind of, maybe she can't hear me.
Not always sense and logic in these things.
Yeah. Okay, let me put this out there. I guess what Miriam is expressing is two things, whether or not, Matt Piacenza, there's a political will and whether it will be a sufficient public outcry.
Yeah, I think so far we've just seen a real lack of urgency, especially from, you know, our more powerful leaders up at the Capitol and obviously the governor himself. A very quick review, we had, you know, five bills introduced by Democrats. One of them did pass, a nice bill from Representative Patrice Arendt, which will require state agencies and school boards to review their current efforts to address air issues and then put in place additional measures. It doesn't require anything in particular, so I think the range of what will come out of that will probably be quite wide, but I'm sure there will be some positive steps. We then had a pair of bills from Republicans to boost compressed natural gas vehicles and infrastructure. And I'd love to talk about that a little more because I think it raises some interesting questions about, you know, what the motivation is for that particular strategy and whether it really is the most effective bang for the buck.
Well, Terry, you've talked about that in terms of, at least from Republicans, that compressed natural gas, that's what they're focusing on. It seems to be anyway.
Yeah, I spoke with Republican Majority Leader Brad Dee a few weeks ago before these especially the energy amendments bill, which Matt is talking about, which really motivates compressed natural gas production and consumption. That was still sort of on the drawing board for Republicans. But as sort of a pro-business conservative idea, Republicans see this not only as a way to reduce air pollution, but to seize upon a business opportunity. And that's what SB 275 does. That bill will pass. And it sets up a commission which gives municipalities the chance to borrow money to convert fleet vehicles and buy new compressed natural gas vehicles. That money can be paid back to the state at a relatively low interest rate in a very easy way. It also calls upon a, quote, gas company, and we know that to be Questar, to build a natural gas fueling infrastructure up and down the Wasatch Front and basically recover most, if not all, of those costs in doing that. And I'm sure Matt wants to talk about this and Judy as well, but this sort of opens a Pandora's box about where we get this compressed natural gas, where it's harvested, and Republicans make no bones about the fact that they want it harvested in Utah.
Yeah. Judy, what do you make of that, this focus?
Well, it is an intriguing bill, and I think that if I were to sum up the whole legislative session, I would say that I don't think we really know whether it's been a net positive or a net negative for air quality. And this bill is a big factor in that. We talk a lot in Utah, and they talk a lot in the legislature, about data and evidence for the decisions that are being made. And I don't know about you gentlemen, but one of the things that struck me about this SB 275 is that there's really very little discussion about it for the amount of money that's on the table and for the reach of the bill.
You mean harvesting natural gas? Is that what you mean?
Well, not the harvesting the natural gas part, but is this a cost-effective solution to air quality problems? And people, I think on the floor, they described it as a quantum leap in solving the air pollution problem. But it's interesting because car for car or vehicle for vehicle, Utah has more, I think, six times more natural gas fueling stations already than California, six times as many. Wow. So do we really need to expand our network or do we really need to expand our fleet of these very expensive vehicles? I'm not really sure. Does it make sense to convert buses and promote natural gas vehicles, new vehicles, maybe. But again, that was never for something that involves this amount of money and an issue of such important, great concern to the public. I'm really surprised that we didn't spend a lot more time talking about the consequences and the financials of this.
You're worried about that too, of course, Matt Pichenza.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's unusual is you look at another natural gas bill, the HB 96, which offers a tax credit to folks who purchase or convert their cars. A CNG conversion or purchase gets $2,500. A hybrid or electric gets $605. And I don't think there's anyone alive who can say, well, that's because a natural gas vehicle is four times as effective at removing pollutants from the air, particularly than an electric vehicle. And so it does feel in a lot of ways like this reflects more about the power of Questar and the power of the natural gas industry in our state than it does, as Judy's saying, a sort of statistically based effort to really figure out how can we clean up our vehicle fleet. There's another thing we've been thinking a lot about and talking about that's not getting a lot of attention, and that is for Utah to be at the forefront of pushing for much cleaner cars, period. And California is a place that a lot of folks look at, and you know the word California raises some ire up on the Hill. That's some scary folks over there with their liberal ideas. But they have made some enormous strides forward in cleaning things up, and one of the biggest ways they've done that is leading the country in an aggressive new emissions controls for vehicles. And there's something called Tier 3 standards, and this gets complicated, but you know we could make our gas a lot cleaner for a penny a gallon. We could make all new cars a lot cleaner for $150 a car. And California's leading the way. The EPA is looking at doing it nationally. And this is a place where we see, you know, Governor Herbert and the legislature could step forward and say, you know what? We do have a crisis. We do have an emergency. It's time to stop being reactive and be proactive. And let's have the cleanest cars possible, you know, a wide range of options. And instead of doing that, it feels like they're sort of putting all their eggs into the CNG basket. And, you know, every CNG car on the road that replaces an older car is a step in the right direction. But is it the best bet and the biggest bang for the Utah taxpayer buck? I don't think anyone really has either shown that or even thinks it, frankly.
801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Let's go back to the phones. Pablo is with us in Salt Lake. Hi, Pablo.
Hi. Thanks, Doug, for taking my call. I just have a couple quick comments, and then I'll take my answer off the air. But this topic of having to wait until there's some sort of scientific evidence that there's a health hazard, as opposed to doing something about a problem that we know exists. I mean, by the time we have actual proof that there's a health hazard and that we're poisoning ourselves, won't it be already so much damage that's been done that could we live with ourselves? The other comment that I have is when I look at some of the proposals that have been floated, especially from the politicians in this state, I'm just dumbfounded by how little they really seem to want to do about the problem. 55 miles an hour on the freeway while we increase auto traffic and increase industry, I don't think is really going to do much. And when it comes down to the question of why it is that Governor Herbert and the rest of the politicians aren't really doing anything as aggressive as California, I think it basically comes down to they don't see a financial benefit in it, whereas California seems to have more of a progressive level of thinking on these kind of issues. We're going to need some really aggressive thinking for this kind of issue in this state. Thank you for taking my call, and I'll take any comments off.
Great. Okay, two parts there. Let's start with the first one. Terry, this question of information, you know, and it was a question I put to Dr. Payne, you know, in terms of the actual connecting the dots causality, in terms of knowing the chemistry of a PM2.5, why should that matter? Why should we wait? Because you've talked about the fact that this question of getting independent information seems to be one of the takeaways you've gotten from these conversations.
Well, Pablo is right in asking the question, why do we have to wait before it is essentially too late? But I think what we need to do, there needs to be some kind of push to get credible information that lawmakers or people in power can that will motivate them to make tough choices. That's what we're talking about. And we've got an industry that's policing itself. Point source polluters are policing themselves. They're coming out with information. Activists on the other end are saying that information is not credible. Those numbers are too low. In the meantime, as we're having a debate about information, the damage is already being done. So it does come down to finding some kind of credible information that all sides can accept and move forward with. And maybe the university's Center for Air Quality, Health, and Society is a start to that. I'm not sure.
Gina, what do you think?
Well, I think that Pablo did raise a great question about, you know, whether you wait for information. And to me, it raises goes back to the data or science issue, and that is, well, if you're going to require X amount of science and causality to decide that air pollution is worth monitoring or regulating because of the health implications, it would seem that you would want to do the same thing with the other side of that. What is the value of controls and what sort of economic benefits controls bring? In the legislative hearing that they had in October, Dr. Pope, Arden Pope from BYU, mentioned that he'd been involved in a study where they found that $1 of spending on air pollution controls yielded $10 in benefits in terms of health quality and other measurable values. So, again, it seems like that might be a good place to sort of coalesce. But I do think that we already have a lot of information that can help us shape the day-to-day going forward.
Matt?
Yeah, I think Pablo is right on, and I think by no means do we need to wait. You should obviously do both. You should move forward in significant improvements while studying. But I return to your first topic on this weeks ago on mass transit, and we just know that, you know, the communities of tomorrow, the 21st century Utah, folks want denser, more livable, more walkable, more transit. They want to be able, as you noted at the time, to look at their phones and, you know, on the train instead of driving. So, you know, if we can finally turn away from, you know, such a car-centric vision for the future of Utah and turn towards something which, you know, would not only clean our air, but also, you know, bring, you know, the sort of wave of the different kind of sustainable future that so many folks seem to want, you know, why not do all those things at once?
Matt Pacenza with us, policy director of the advocacy group Heal Utah. Judy Faze, also here, covers pollution, climate change, and nuclear waste for the Salt Lake Tribune. And Carrie Gilday is KUER's news director. We invite you to join us, 801-585-WEST, the number. Pablo, thanks very much. You can email us, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another brief break and be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are wrapping up our series on Utah's bad air, and we hope you'll join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Let's take a call. Richard is with us in Salt Lake. Richard, welcome.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah. So I know that we've been talking about we can't pin down. There's things that we can't pin down yet as far as the science goes and how these things, how the poor air quality is affecting us and what exactly we can do about that. We can't pin these things down exactly yet until we have the data that we're working so hard to get. But I've got a 3-year-old boy and he's been on antibiotics 3 times this year between his sicknesses of the flu or these, you know, the earaches that he's had. He's had a constant cough and the constant nose drip, you know, things like that. And so, you know, my assumption has been that it has been because of the air quality. Can't say that for sure at this point for the same reasons. The data is just not there. But that being said, you know, the thing that we have been able to get to is that the air quality is bad for us, you know. And so I know the answers to, or at least some answers to what we can do to help the air quality itself. But as far as answers to how can we help our kids, you know, it seems like we're dealing with air quality that we haven't had to before. How can we help our kids, you know, better combat the air quality that you know, does have a bad effect on them? And are there resources out there that we can get to? It seems like if there's worse air quality, there may be must be more that we need to do.
Richard, are you saying – you're saying, look, we know this is having an effect on kids. My kid is one of them is what you're saying. And what you're saying – but is there something we can do now? Is that what you're asking?
Well, yeah. I mean, are there – I know – I'm not sure if there's a doctor on the program right now. But, I mean, are there you know, measures that I can take health-wise? You know, I mean, I feel like I get my kid the right kind of diet that I – you know, and have a healthy child. Otherwise,
well, let's put that. That's a good. It's a good question.
Measures that I can take.
Let's put this to Matt. Matt, what do you think? I mean, what?
I mean, I've got two little kids as well, two under eight, and you know, obviously, you know, we have from I believe the state education folks pretty clear guidelines on PM 2.5 levels and whether you're you know supposed to go outside and exercise or not, but. You know, it's difficult. I mean, we're not capable of moving in the short term. We can't, you know, go to our, you know, mountain home in Park City for January. You know, most of us don't have those kinds of options. So I hate to say it. I think, you know, use a little common sense, keep your kids indoors and then get involved. You know, groups like HEAL, groups like the Utah Moms, the doctors, you know, we all need help and we need to build a base of outraged parents and citizens and students and folks who will, you know, really push our leaders to embrace this new vision for the different Utah that is built around different values.
Let me ask about that because and thanks, Richard, for the call. The tone of the conversation. I want to ask about that. A few weeks ago, Judy, you reported when the governor met with these clean air activists and he mentioned that some of them had apologized to him for the behavior of some of his – of their colleagues, that they – there was a lack of professionalism and, as the governor put it, a kind of rude approach. And then in January, I guess the director of the Division of Environmental Quality, Amanda Smith, told environmental activists that their tone had been an obstacle to political action. How do you – what do you understand in terms of that? Is this – What do you make of that, the tone of the conversation?
Well, I remember when I covered the legislature, I thought it was always very interesting having come from Washington covering Congress where a lot of the debate was out in the public. In Utah, people like their dirty laundry in behind closed doors. And so caucuses meet behind closed doors so that they can fully talk and freely talk and voice their opinions. But it's always done in quiet. And I think that that embarrassment doesn't really go over well on the Capitol, whether it's the legislature or the governor. And in a way, that's what I think the purpose of some of the activists has been, is to embarrass leaders into action. So that's sort of the way I see it, is that there's a difference in perception of how to be effective.
Matt, do you worry about that?
You know, I think it's a good rule of thumb that we should always go after the policies and not the person. But with that said, I get a little irritated because, you know, I sat in a hearing on an air quality bill on Thursday last week and Representative Mike Noel, Republican from Kanab, accused an environmental attorney who was trying to make a case for why this was needed of hating his children and grandchildren. And Representative Noel's powerful, runs the House Natural Resources Committee and regularly berates and treats environmentalists with contempt and journalists and all kinds of folks and accuses them of hating children and wanting to perpetuate global poverty and usher in some, you know, socialist, you know, inferno. And I don't recall either Governor Herbert or Ms. Smith ever having, you know, accused Mike Noel of sort of bringing down the debate or being too personal. So it's one-sided, and I feel like it is frankly an effort a lot of the time to try to silence us and to try to get us to show less urgency. So again, I'd rather talk about policy than people. I think we should all try to do that. But let's not pretend that it's only environmentalists who occasionally are a bit shriller than they should be.
Here's an email from, I think, from Michael, who writes, I think change will inevitably be slow. And he writes, hinge on gradual shifts of individual will. Last year, I finally decided to give up my car. It took a long time to reach that tipping point, though. I've been walking, cycling, and taking public transit. And while some things have been hard on balance, the benefits, he says, have been tremendous. I believe, he writes, it's only through the collective momentum of individual choices, big, small, gradual, and over time, that will that change will slowly be made. So let me ask you all this sort of, I guess, finally, as we're coming to the end here. How do you keep the momentum of an issue like this up when you've got, again, good air, at least today, Terry?
I think, you know, you continue with the sacrifices you made in January, continue to make them in March and April and May. I know that my wife and I, we have two small kids who have to go to daycare. We've been trying to keep one car in the driveway every day and take only one car out. And one of us take the bus and either to or from work. And we're going to continue to do that. Judy brought up a great point in the show we did a few weeks ago on point source pollution. Judy, you said people would accept more responsibility and do their part if they knew what they were supposed to do and to make a difference. And really, it's about communicating. And as Matt said, it's about that community getting involved, coming together collectively, and taking that anxiety and that anger and even that bad air issue fatigue and focusing it on some kind of action.
Judy?
Well, I see two big factors going forward. One of these goes to Richard's point and to something that Rob Payne brought up, and that is individuals do have to take or are empowered to take a certain amount of responsibility over their own health and their children's health. And you can go to the Utah Asthma Program webpage and also to Breathe Utah's webpage. They actually have specific tools that will help parents understand when air pollution is becoming a problem for their kids. On the government front, I think the fact that the state has a gun to its head or the EPA is holding its feet to the fire means that PM 2.5 pollution will have to be addressed in the plan that is due in the summer. So the issue will be on the table, at least for the next few months.
And Matt, as you can tell, that music's coming, so make it quick.
Yeah, just urge folks to get involved. Look for groups like Heal Utah, sign up for emails, come to hearings, write letters, do all the good old-fashioned stuff that citizen activists do to make change.
It's Matt Pacenza, Policy Director for the advocacy group Heal Utah. Thanks, Matt, for being with us. Judy Fase covers pollution, climate change, nuclear waste for the Salt Lake Tribune. Judy, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Terry, thanks very much.
Thanks, Doug.
KUER's News Director, Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.